Andrea, and I am an alcoholic.
Hello,
friends. It's great to be back up here. It's a beautiful country, and it was a very pleasant drive. I asked a couple of people I sponsor, but they're working. Well, they have other plans, and but it was very fun to come out by myself, and I was listening to my sponsor on CD, and it was good. It was really good. Like I said, I am an alcoholic, a recovered alcoholic. I'm hopeless kind of the mind and body, but I'm not cured by all means. And my sobriety date, last time I took a drink, was on my mom's funeral, and that was June 21, 1981. And I do have a home group. We call ourselves the Jaywalkers. And I really love that part in the big book. And it's funny. And we're a lot of fun. We're not a glum lot. But we meet on Tuesdays and on Friday nights. Tuesday night is a speaker meeting in Richmond. And on Friday night, we have an open beginners meeting from 7 to 7:45. Then we have a little break. And then we have a main meeting, which is, of course, from the big book, from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock. So if you're ever in the Richmond area on Tuesday or Friday nights, come and visit us. So we're at the Bonaire Presbyterian Church in Bonaire. I'll tell you what it was like and how what I became and what I am today a little bit of. I grew up in Pennsylvania in the mountains, in the Pocono Mountains in Pennsylvania on a large, large dairy farm. And there was a lot of drinking and a lot of unhealthy behaviors in my household, and it seemed like everybody, as soon as they graduated high school, that was their goal, is just get off the farm and get happy, you know, find someone to make you happy or find something to make you happy too, and I did that, you know. I grew up and my sister, my one sister, she's 16 years older than me, and she was a great cook. She knew how to make good pastries and chocolate pudding. And she used to say, "I love plum pudding." I don't remember that. But anyway, I do remember her wines. You know, I remember she used to make delicious elderberry wine and dandelion wine. And dandelion wine, it was very wicked strong, and it looked ugly because it kind of had like a beer color to it, but it was kind of hazy and had raisins in it, and it was very powerful, and she kept it up in the attic. I don't know why. I guess she was a brewmaster, and it's funny, too. I shouldn't say this. I love my sisters dearly and my brother. She used to make elderberry wine, and I think she still does. She said that's good for your arthritis, and she has really bad arthritis. I don't know if she didn't even drink enough. She's not alcoholic, so maybe that's, I don't know. But I remember going up in the attic once when I was a little youngster, a young'un, about 13 years old or 14, and I remember drinking that, and it was very hot upstairs in the attic. It was in an old farmhouse, and but I liked what it did to me for some reason, you know, and I continued to like what alcohol did to me. I remember drinking a lot of blackberry brandy with my mom when my dad would go out on a spree and not come back for a couple of days. She used to take me down to, we had a big upright two-door freezer and take frozen food out, and we'd be eating frozen meat pies, chicken pies or whatever. And she was a good cook, too, but I didn't like them frozen. But I liked the blackberry brandy. I don't know why, I just liked it. Oh, I know why today. You know, and she was paying attention to me. My mom was a very unhappy lady, you know. And my dad was, too. He was very depressed. And he was on a farm, but he had some education as being a diesel engine mechanic, and he loved to tinker around with diesel engines. But my mom didn't want to be around a lot of people, you know. So they bought this big farm in the Poconos in PA. There was a lot of craziness, but there's a lot of craziness in everybody's family. And like I said, my sister, my two sisters, they're not alcoholic, but I know my brother, that's 14 years older than me, or he's alcoholic, you know, and I mean, you know, he drank a lot, and then he went to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist cured him and put him on a lot of medications, and he's still crazy, but he's not drinking, you know, and then I have another sister that's a year and a half older than me, and she drank a lot. She was a heavy drinker, and she's, you know, but when she gave up drinking, you know, her life didn't get worse. My life got worse when I gave up drinking. And then I have another brother. He was 4 years older than me. And him and I used to fight like heck, you know. And he was an alcoholic, but he did a lot of street drugs. And a year before I came into the program, he killed himself. I thought he was crazy doing drugs. I thought that was so bad, it's illegal. But I used to drive drunk a lot, you know. And my car... I used to have a lot of old cars, and well, not, you know, back then they were old, 25 years ago, 26. But they used to look like a Dutch comforter, a quilt, you know, with different colors always, because park cars would run into me, or apple trees or whatever, you know. As soon as I graduated. Before I even graduated, I went to Heart Lake to a square dance, and I met my ex-husband. And I really, you know, he was a handsome man. He had a beautiful voice. He was an engineer and an announcer at one of the radio stations in New York City. Where I lived was like 2 hours from New York City. I liked his car, and he was handsome, and he had good, you know, he had a beautiful voice, and he had a beautiful bar in his car. That's what really attracted me, too. Today I could look back and say that. But, he was a very, very unhealthy person, too. You know, angels don't attract devils, I guess. And I was, you know, I was off my walk. You know, I just wanted to get off the farm and get out of that unhealthiness, and I found... You know, this guy at Heart Lake, and I married him as soon as I got out of school, you know. And I remember before, you know, we were dating and so forth and drinking in the car and, you know, doing crazy stuff. And I remember going to his mom's house, and his mom was quite a bit older than him, of course. But she had him, when she was going through menopause. And so she was an older lady back then. But anyhow, he slapped his mom in the face. And, you know, I kind of like, whoa. And I told my mom, and my mother said that any person that would strike their own parent would strike anyone. And I figured, well, what does she know? You know, I mean, it's true. Like, our marriage, what kept us together was alcohol. And it was just very ugly, and I never missed the farms or that their kind of unhealthiness, because I married unhealthiness, you know, and I was unhealthy, you know, because, you know, I drank, and I used to go visit him up at that TV station or radio station, wherever he was working, and drive up there drunk and pass out and just drive home the next day and go to work and think nothing is wrong with that, you know. And all I did was basically work and drink and go to work and pass out and just puke. And it was just ugly. I was a drinker and a puker, and it was just disgusting. And had a lot of car accidents, was in the hospital quite often, and had a lot of broken bones, had my nose broken 3 or 4 times by my ex, and I beat him up, and it was just ugly, it was just unhealthy, and I even wanted a child, but by the grace of God, I never had a child in that relationship, because it was very, very unhealthy. And anyway, after my brother passed away in 1979, my mom got really sick. And they just kept saying, oh, it's all in your head, you know, you're just grieving, and that's why you're losing weight. And my mom was always sick. I remember when I was a kid, my brother that committed suicide, he used to say if mom wasn't complaining, she must be really sick, you know. And she did. She complained a lot, and my father would be very depressed, and he would go out and come back and beat her up or whatever. And it was just unhealthiness. Yeah, but I know I'm not an alcoholic because of that. I have a disease. And because my sisters, they're not alcoholic, and they were, grew up in the same environment. But anyhow, you know, my brother passed away, and then my mother got really, really sick, you know. And so, you know, they were just saying, you know, just don't worry about it. They gave her a lot of different medications, try to calm her nerves and all that back then. And it really wasn't working. And she even tried to commit suicide because she was in a lot of pain emotionally and physically. And she was in emotional pain all her life, you know, and so was my father. And they were living in untreated alcoholism or active alcoholism. Anyway, you know, she went in the hospital like in January, and they said if it's a long procedure, that's a good sign. But if it's a short procedure, it'll be a negative sign. And it was a very short procedure, and they found out that she had pancreatic cancer. You know, and the one thing my mom told me in the hospital, when she was in and out of the hospital, mostly in the hospital, and she volunteered herself to be, I forgot what they call it, but it was a volunteer to use all kind of new medications and procedures on her to find different ways to treat pancreatic cancer. You know, and they gave her like 2 months to live, but she did live 6 months. But anyway, I would go visit her, and I was all black and blue, and you know, hungover from drinking the night before, or even maybe in that morning, whatever. And it was just ugly. You know, I'd go see her, and I would be sad, but I was unable to cry. I don't know why. You know, I think I cried more since I got sober. But you know, I would go visit her, and I was living up in Binghamton, New York at that time, too. And she was in a hospital in Scranton, PA. I would go visit her and all that. And one day she just looked at me and she said, you know, you look a lot worse than I am. And she said, if you don't change, you're going to die. Wind up just like me. And I thought she meant that I was going to get cancer like her. And I'm going to die on my deathbed hating life. And she basically was. She was basically hating life. And she was even filing for divorce from my father. And it was just ugly, and my dad was sick, and it was just crazy. So, yeah, I went back up to Binghamton, and I thought, you know, I just can't drink safely. I tried every which way to control my drinking, and the more I controlled it, the more uncomfortable I got. You know, I wasn't doing the thing, and you know, I drank to be part of the world because I felt so isolated, and I thought it was because of the way I was brought up or something, you know, but that's not true at all. And you know, I tried to control it. I even got a book from the library about how to drink. I don't know, can't even remember it because I was drinking when I was reading it, and it was hot out, and I was outside, and I was reading it, tried to learn how to drink safely. And I passed out, and I remember I got a bad sunburn, so I stopped reading that book because it's not a good thing, you know, to get a sunburn. But anyway, you know, I did, you know, finally called up Alcoholics Anonymous in Binghamton, New York, and I remember talking to Bill, and Bill was a great guy, and he told me, he said, well, there's a meeting at St. Francis. In the school at St. Francis in Binghamton, and he said, just pack a lunch and go there. And I thought, well, gee, they must have a picnic or something, but he said, pack a lunch, and he said, take a little money. He said, but you don't have to give anything if you don't have any money. And you know, I always was a taker, so that was a good suggestion. I don't have to give, you know. So I did go to that meeting, and it was a 12 o'clock meeting, and back then when I was drinking, I really enjoyed when I was drinking to work second shift, you know, because I could drink after work from 1 o'clock to whenever and get up real late and just go right to work, you know, and I didn't have much of a morning, you know, and I didn't drink that often before I went to work because I probably still had a hangover from the night before. So I did go to that noon meeting, and it was a nice meeting. I went to AA. My first meeting was in March of 1981, and I went there, and I was just sitting in a car, and I had a a Pepsi or a Diet Coke. I remember drinking Diet Cokes a lot back then, diet sodas, because I didn't want to gain weight, get a lot of sugar, you know, and never thought about all the sugar and alcohol. But anyway, I was sitting in the parking lot, and I thought, I wonder if those are alcoholics that are going to that meeting. They're not carrying nothing in. And I didn't take my lunch with me, but I did take my Diet Coke to that meeting, and it was a discussion meeting. But there was something in that meeting. I don't know. There were, and I know what it is today, is that unconditional love, and that it's this, the spirit being alive today, you know, when you're sober and not drinking and doing the deal out of the big book and being of service to others. But anyway, there was something I liked at that meeting. There was an attraction there. You know, it was downstairs in school in this here room, and there was a lot of windows on one wall. It was all windows, with high windows, and looked right into the backyard, and there was a lot of dead old brush out there, and a lot of ugliness out there, but there was a lot of warmth and a lot of beautiness in that meeting. And there was people from all different walks, you know, people from the park bench to Park Avenue was there. But there was that unconditional love, you know, and I didn't know what it was back then. Yeah, and I was unable to say I was an alcoholic at that meeting. And for quite a while, I would just say, I'm Andrea, and I think I'm an alcoholic. I'm not sure. And people would laugh. And I thought, they either know I'm not an alcoholic or they know I am. I'm not sure. You know? And I remember going to that meeting, and there was a man there named Eugene, and he was he's a great big tall guy, and he, you know, looks like a football player, but he was talking about his experience, and he killed a kid, a 7-year-old boy, on a bicycle on Conklin Avenue, and I lived on Conklin Avenue back then, and I seen that accident, and like I said, I tried to have a child, but I just couldn't, and that just devastated me when I seen that kid fly off the bike and hit a green big dump truck, and the kid was killed immediately. But Eugene caused the accident because he was drunk driving and he was just speeding up the road, and that scared me about Eugene too. But what really scared me is not what he did, but it's like I could have done the same thing, because like I said, I hit a lot of apple trees, and I hit a lot of one time I hit a pig, and I try to tell an insurance company the pig jumped out in front of me, and they didn't believe it, you know, because it didn't. And that really scared me. And also, after the meeting, he told me, he said, you know, you gotta go to meetings, and you gotta pray, and you gotta get a sponsor. And he said, don't mess up the process, you know. And it scared me, because, you know, my mother said, I'll die like her, live whatever, and I didn't want to do that anymore. So, you know, I went to that meeting hoping that I wouldn't die like my mom, and hoping AA would teach me how to drink sensibly, you know, and like a lady, and not pass out and puke, you know, and that was the honest truth. That's why I went to the meetings, and that meeting especially. And anyway, after I was going to that meeting, I told Tony Kay, and he was a very beautiful person in my life, and I did get a sponsor. I did follow directions because I was so desperate, you know, and desperate, feeling that desperate even today is a gift for me, because I know there's some kind of change that God has to do in my life today. But back then, I didn't know God could do the changes. I thought I could do the changes, and just by being good, I'll get good. And that never works in my life because I'm so powerless. Anyway, I did get a sponsor. I got Elizabeth, and she was my first sponsor, you know, and she was a beautiful lady, and she told me to stay on step 1, 2, and 3 for a whole year, you know, and back then up there, maybe in a lot of areas, I'm not sure, she gave me what she could give me, and she was a beautiful lady. You know, she told me go to a lot of meetings, like, go there 20 minutes early, and stay 20 minutes afterwards so people could get to know you. You could get to know other people, and also you could help set up the meeting. You could help clean up after the meeting. You know, she said, this isn't a self-service this isn't a cater program. We all have to help each other and help set up the meeting and make sure it's there for the newcomer and for the old-timer or anyone that's not feeling well or even feeling good, that it be there. And so that was really good advice, you know, and go to meetings early and stay afterwards and help. And I still do that a lot today. I like to get to meetings early, and I like to stay afterwards a little to help clean up. And anyway, I listened to that advice, and you know, and I did. I got active in service work, and I remember Tony had me wash the ashtrays. They used to smoke a lot back then, you know, and I did that for quite a while, and I used to set up the books and all that, and there was something going on in my life I didn't know what, you know. I wasn't drinking, for one thing, you know, and I started to see better. And I remember talking to this one lady in AA saying, you know, this is a beautiful area. The scenery is gorgeous. It's just like here, the rolling hills. And the hills here, I think, are bigger, but it's just beautiful. And she said they were always there all your life, but you weren't there all your life, you know. And that's true. You know, today I could not be here, really, and be in my own head. But, you know, I followed Elizabeth's suggestions, and I stayed close to her, and I got to be in inner group, and I went to GSR meetings, and they were really nasty. They smoked a lot and yelled a lot, but there was an energy there, too. And the nice thing about it is, you know, it wasn't like my family. You know, my family will never be the Waltons. They'll always be the Walnuts, but at these meetings, after they fought, they would just go up to each other and hug each other, shake each other's hand, and, you know, resolve whatever was there, you know, instead of carrying that their resentment all their lives around. But, yeah, I did that, but I never went to the big book or the 12 steps, not even the 12 and 12 with Elizabeth. Yeah, and I remember I was sober about a year and a half, and it was just crazy. And I go, could I do my 12 steps, my fourth step? Yeah, because I knew in my heart, with all my heart, that I know I cannot drink safely, because I remember telling Tony once, this was when I first came in the first month, that I wanted to learn how to drink safely. And I remember Tony Kay saying that you can't drink safely because you can't even think safely, you know, and you're an alcoholic, you know, and you just got to admit to yourself and know that, you know, you're just powerless over alcohol. And he said, and you need to learn how your life was so unmanageable, you know, because I thought being unmanageable was like being unemployed, and I always was employed, you know. I don't know, by the grace of God, I always had a job. And I remember back then I worked at GAF, and it was easy to work there because it was working in the dark, you know. And one job was a big machine. They made all kind of film for taking pictures, movie pictures, x-raying people's inner arm or whatever, x-ray film, and not x-rated film, but x-ray film. He worked in the dark there, so it was easy to go in hungover, drunk or whatever, because it was just crazy. But anyway, I didn't see my life unmanageable, you know, and I knew in a lot of ways my life was manageable, because I thought I was a functional alcoholic, you know, but there's no such thing, you know. You're either alcoholic or not, you know. And I did do a lot of things that I thought made me different than you folks, you know. I always try to separate myself, you know, like I never got a DWI or driving while intoxicated or anything like that, and I never was arrested, and I never did this, and I never did that. And I remember Tony Kane saying that, you know, you have all the, you know, not yet, you got the yes, but, you know, you will probably do that and plus if you ever go back out. And for some reason I had a lot of respect for Tony, and I respected that, and I appreciated that if I ever go out there, you know, I could wind up like my brother, committing suicide or dying a horrible death or whatever, or killing someone. And that's what really scared me. I didn't mind if I died, but if I hurt someone or killed a child or injured anyone in a horrible car accident, it would just devastate me. So I really looked at how my life was unmanageable, and it was, you know, and because I was living in a delusional world, you know, I would lie about silly things. You know, if you asked me, you know, is this your watch? I would say, of course it is. I paid $2,500 for it, you know, and I probably stole it off someone, and I did borrow it off of Sam. But you know, I would lie about things that don't make sense, you know, and that would, my life would be so unmanageable, you know. And even when I was a kid, I would do that. My mind is a lot different than the normal person, you know, the ordinary person. It's just different. I remember being a kid, going shopping with my dad and my sister that's a year and a half old, year older than me, and he would buy something for her, and I would say, yeah, I want that blue jacket, and he'd go, you don't like blue, and you look really good in red, and I loved red, and I still like red today, and I go, no, I want what she has, you know, and I always wanted what someone else had instead of what my heart really wanted, and I always was living in my head. You know, and it was a very dangerous neighborhood, and very confusing, and very unmanageable, and I would just focus on those crazy things, and that helped me a lot. Like, I never wrote out anything about my unmanageability, and I never liked step two, and I always avoided that step, you know, because I didn't want to be crazy. I didn't want to be like my mother and father and my brother. I thought my brother was crazy. That's why he took his own life. You know, but he was on a lot of street drugs, you know. And my mom was on a lot of prescription drugs. And that's why part of her life she was really sick and really depressed and emotionally unwell. But, you know, it just scared me. And I would go to step two meetings and finally, I did get to step four, and I remember writing step four, and I didn't have directions. You know, I went to 12 and 12 meetings, that's a great book. You know, I loved St. Francis Prayer. I do that quite often, it was just missing in my life, and I would talk to Elizabeth, and I would say, I don't know how to do this. And she'd go, talk to other people. And I did. I even asked people if I could see their fourth step, and they never showed me that. But they would talk to me how they did it. They went through they used part of the big book. They used the 12 and 12. They used this other book. It was a little red book back then. And, you know, it was just getting more confusing. So I the first fourth step I ever did, it was like a year and a half sober. And I did it like an essay, you know. And back then, where I got sober, they would say, you got to look at your assets and your liabilities. You got to put all that down, you know. And I didn't know too much what's good about me or what's bad about me. I was in such self-hate or whatever, you know. And without the alcohol, I was in such fear, you know. And with the alcohol, I was in fear, but I didn't realize it. But without alcohol, I realized that I had all these feelings I couldn't even identify, but there was the core thread of that confusion and delusion of feelings was fear for me. But I did finally did the fourth step, and I made an appointment with Elizabeth, and you know, we did it and so forth. And I never did a third step with Elizabeth. You know, I never knelt down and really looked at and did the second step. I never did a really thorough second step back then to really know that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And because I was scared of it, and Elizabeth never took me through that, and she did it the way she knew how, you know, and by the grace of God, and I'm so grateful that you know, June 21, 1981, my mother passed away a couple of days before that, and on that day it was her funeral, and that was my last drink. I did pick up a drink on the 21st of June of 1981, and that was my last drink. But you know, and there was no reason to pick up that drink. You know, it was whatever it was, because I was in untreated alcoholism, and I was just crazy, and I didn't believe that I was crazy, and I didn't believe that a power greater than myself could restore me, and, you know, and I never looked at the fact that God is or God isn't, you know. I never really felt that in my heart until I did the process through the big book with a sponsor I met in Richmond 6 years ago, you know. And but, you know, I'm really grateful for that gift of sobriety on the 21st of June, you know, physical sobriety, you know. And so, you know, I did the best I can, you know, and I went to meetings, and I haven't had a drink since then. And you know, I was about 8 years sober and physically sober, and I got just crazy, you know. I didn't know what was going on in my life, and it was untreated alcoholism, you know. I was doing stuff worse than I was when I was drinking, you know. I was getting fired, just horrible things, and I wasn't even with my unhealthy husband at the time. I was only with my unhealthy self at that time, and so, you know, instead of talking with my sponsor, and she would only say, just go to meetings and don't drink. You know, she never explained to me what was going on. I never really did a thorough fourth step or a thorough fifth step, because I never did the first three steps thorough. I did the first steps thorough, but not two and three. You know, and so I was crazy. And in the 80s, late 80s, I thought, well, maybe if I get my nose operated on, I'll feel better. You know, and I did. I got my nose operated on, my ears, my toes. And I thought, well, maybe if I got my eyes a different color. But I didn't do that. But I did all that other stuff to try to feel better. And I remember my sponsor back then used to say, just go shopping and buy a blouse. You'll probably feel better. And I did that. I bought a lot of material things, you know. And I remember going up to the mall. Unfortunately, this lady knew me. And she knew I was in the store, that same store the week before, and I was trying to buy the same blouse I bought the week before, and I never worn. You know, it's like, yeah, and I was trying to fix my feelings. I wanted to feel better, you know. And so I went to a therapist. I thought, well, maybe this will help me, because after I had my feet operated on, my nose, my ears, and so forth, and it was just crazy, you know. And this therapist, she helped me somewhat, you know. I don't know how, you know. I guess she really, yeah, I don't know if she really helped me, but anyway, she helped take my money away from me, but so I wouldn't have to buy that much other stuff. But anyhow, I did go see her for quite a while, but she did help me go back to college, you know, and because I was working at General Electric back then. And I went back to college, and I checked out some careers I thought I would like, and I liked what I was doing at GE Aerospace back then, and I was basically a tester working with engineers and seeing what a problem is and finding a solution, you know. And that's what I should have been doing in my private life, but I wasn't, and I was unable to. But anyway, I was going to this therapist for quite a while. I went to college, and I moved away, and then in the 90s, I went up to Utica, New York, to college up there, and I changed my career, and it was okay. You know, I was a dry drunk. I was just barely going to meetings. I was going even to meetings that I had I had no reason to be there. You know, I went to NA. I never did drugs. I never did street drugs. You know, I guess I have a choice over those drugs, but I definitely don't have a choice over alcohol. And I would go to different meetings. I was just crazy, and I was just, and I got pretty good marks. You know, I even had to go to classes to learn how to learn, because when I was a kid, you know, my mind was just crazy, like I was in that delusional world, that, you know, and just in a lot of fear and a lot of imposed fear, you know, in my life. You know, I would do things crazy, like my parents would be fighting, my brother and sister would go hide, I would try to break it up, you know, and I did that all my life, you know, try to fix things, because I was uncomfortable with the noise, basically. Anyway, you know, I went to college, and I did graduate, and I traveled for a short time. And then in 97, I moved to Virginia Beach, and I had got a job there, And I stayed there for about 5 years. And, you know, I was going to a lot of meetings there because when you move to a new area, you feel like a newcomer and you're just excited to meet new people and so forth. But, yeah, there was something missing in my life. You know, there was something really missing in my life. And I had many sponsors since I moved from being up to New York to travel a bit and as a traveling occupational therapist, different buildings, facilities throughout the Midwest. And then when I moved to Virginia Beach, I got a sponsor basically for name, to tell people I got a sponsor, you know, and really not doing anything. And but it did take me through, you know, not through the big book. You know, basically I got the same message, go to meetings, go there early, help out people. And I did do a lot of 12-step work. I did work with a lot of people. I did take people to detoxes and so forth. By the grace of God, that kept me physically sober. But anyway, when I was in Virginia Beach, just life was getting crazier, you know. I was getting fired from jobs, and I was hating my job. I was hating the place I lived, and I was hating this. And basically, I was hating my life, and I was turning up just like my mom and like my brother, like my dad, you know. You know, except with there was no alcohol in my life. So I was really stark raving crazy sober. And I thought of committing suicide down in Virginia Beach. And I was on a big highway between, I can't think of the name of it. But anyway, it was a highway going from Virginia Beach to Portsmouth. And you have to go through the tunnel. And I thought, why don't I just run into their concrete wall? And for some reason, by the grace of God, and I still look at waste management trucks as my angel from God, because I thought, that's what's the problem. I got my garbage in my life yet. I have all these ugly feelings, and I go to meetings, and I'm very depressed, and I'm very negative, and I'm always, you know, I go to meetings, and I just dump all my stuff at meetings, and I'm just in untreated alcoholism, you know, and so I went to this here Tuesday night meeting in Portsmouth, and there was a lady there that I met 5 years before I went to that meeting, because I moved there in 97, and so this was in 2001. I went to this meeting, and this lady, Judith, was there, and I asked her for her phone number, and I got her phone number several times before, and she said, well, I'll give you my phone number, but if you don't call me tomorrow, and she told me a certain time, and she said, if you don't call me, don't ever talk to me again. And that scared me. I don't know why, but it scared me. I guess my spirit was really scared. But anyway, I did call her, and we talked, and she said, bring your 12 and 12 and your big book over to my house and your bathing suit, because she liked to go swimming. And I did. I followed, you know, I was desperate again, just like when I was in that meeting on June 21, 2001, I had that same fear. You know, I just didn't want to die like my brother, because that scared me when I thought of suicide, you know, and that there's self-pity and self-centeredness. And so I went to her, and we started going through the big book and through the 12 and 12. And the 12 and 12 is good information, but it's not, doesn't give me directions like the big book does. But in 2001, in November, I was working with her since September, and I moved up to Richmond, and she told me, suggested to get a sponsor, and I did immediately. I came up here, went to intergroup, found a sponsor, and someone I could relate to, and she was quite negative, too, this lady, and she did the best she can. But anyway, you know, she gave me the when and where to meetings in Richmond, and I talked to her quite a bit on the phone, and basically was talking about other people and not about the solution in the big book, in the program. And anyway, I went to a meeting on a Tuesday night, and I met this lady there, and she had something that I recognized from my very first meeting, that peace and that unconditional love in her heart. And she talked a lot about her higher power, and she even mentioned that she had a 10-step buddies, and she had 11-step buddies that to do the 11-step in the morning and at night to review the day and see where you were wrong, you know, during the day. So anyway, I asked her if she would sponsor me. I took her phone number and we talked a while, and she has much less time than me, and at that time it didn't bother me because I was very desperate, you know, and she had something I didn't have, you know, and she was a teacher and I was the student, and I was ready for some kind of solution in my life because I was in all kind of pollution in my life. So because I was going to all different kind of meetings, you know, it was just crazy. But I went to even Debtors Anonymous looking for the solution, and I'm not in debt, but I went there anyway. I couldn't identify with those people. No. But, yeah, I started working with this lady, and she took me through the big book, and I never went through the big book, a page at a time. And it just, there were so much directions in there. There was so much, chock full of information in there, how to, not to change my life, but to have a higher power renew my heart and to have a transformation in my heart, because, I changed a lot since my first drink, but I didn't have that transformation until I went through the big book, I went through the steps and did the deal, because I never made amends. I did fourth and fifth steps many times, even at the beach. Before I moved up to Richmond, I remember doing a fourth step in 20 minutes, and that sponsor, it wasn't Judith, it was another sponsor, saying, you just got to get a chair and make on your dad is sitting in the chair and just yell at him everything you wanted to yell at him when you were a kid. I go, I don't remember wanting to yell at him, I don't know, but anyway, I didn't do that, but when I moved up here, this lady, she took me through the first step, and we wrote about that. When it says to write, we wrote, and she suggested, and it's a good suggestion, and I use that continually with people I sponsor, is, and when I go through it too, because I'm in a book study, and today at 4:30 I was supposed to be in my book study, but I'm glad I'm with you folks. But we did that, and we looked at step two, and to see that I was a agnostic and atheist, and at times I didn't believe in God, and at times I knew you couldn't prove that God was working in my life, and I believed that God was very selective, God was very judgmental, and so forth and so on. All my negative prejudice, was at God and people around me. The way I thought of God, that's how I treated people too. But, we did that, and it took our time. When we started it, I thought, God, it's going to take us a year and a half to go through these 12 steps, but it didn't. But, we got to the third step, and asked God to build, to relieve me of the bondage of self and to build with me. And that was a good part. But the other part where it says to do with me, as he wills, that didn't set good in me. It's like, I don't know if I want that. Like, I was scared of God. Like, what is he going to do? Send me to, Mexico to be a, whatever down there. It's just scared, that God is going to do whatever he wants with me, But finally I got to that part, and I was willing to be willing, and we did. We knelt down and we said the third step prayer together, and I launched right into my writing my fourth step, and that was the first time I ever followed directions with the guide of the big book and the guidance of my sponsor back then. And and it took me a long time. It took me like 6 months to do it, not correctly, but thoroughly, to do it the way I could understand. I could read it to anyone, and anyone would understand, I could see where the pattern is here, that you're self-centered, you're selfish, and you're self-seeking. And I still could be that way today. And so it was very thorough. That's why it took me so long, and, a little bit at a time, one column at a time, and to fear, and the secrets I wanted to take to my grave, and I told that to my sponsor, what I was afraid to tell anyone else. I never even told that therapist I was seeing. And it's funny, too, I was seeing a therapist in Virginia Beach, and it was ironic. Back then, she said, did you ever go through the 12 steps with anyone. I go, no, and I got 20 years. Why do I got to do it now? I don't have to do it. I'm just miserable, and I'm paying money for you to help me and cure me. But I don't know if I said all that, but it was just ironic that she mentioned that to me. And you know, I did the fourth step. I did the fifth step with my sponsor. It took us like 3 weekends to do it, you know, a lot of breaks and having lunch and all of that. We didn't rush into it, and she never suggested to yell at your father or anything. Yeah, and I did go home, and I took the book down from the book down. It wasn't really on a bookshelf, but, you know, I read that. I read the five proposals. I read the five steps, and I was sure that I had all the cement in place and the stones in place to cross over to the other side. And you know, when I did that sixth step, and she recommended to stay with it for a whole hour, even if you got to set a timer, and I did, because I didn't want to shortchange myself or shortchange God, I don't know. But it was funny, I got down on my knees, and I read the sixth step in the big book, and it's just a short piece, but that's all I need, you know, because God is doing the rest of the work in my life. But, you know, I started telling God about my character defects I want him to remove, like jealousy and being shy, you know, because that's self-centered looking. And I kind of chuckled, because why should I tell God what to remove? God is so powerful. He knows what needs to be removed and what I need to still work with or have him work with to help other people to see not to be like that, because Andre is crazy in that area. Anyway, that was the most powerful step I ever did, was my sixth step. And I did that, then I started to list the people I harmed, you know, and became willing to look at those people that I harmed, you know. And then I took that over to my sponsor, and she said, your father isn't on there. I go, well, I didn't harm him, he harmed me, you know. And she said, you don't see the harm you did to your father? And we even talked about it in the fifth step, that I did harm my dad, because whenever he would come over to see me, I never forgave him. You know, I always was seeing him as a mean, nasty old man, hateful man, and he beat me up, and he caused damage to my ear and my nose and all this, and I was just hating him. And in my fifth step, my sponsor pointed that out, that, you know, you were unforgiving of him. You didn't see him as a sick person, you know, and you had a wall up, and, you were not able to help him in any way with your attitude of being better than him. And I did, you know, but I did. I put his name on the list, and I looked at how I harmed him, and I did. I did go up to, he was in a facility up in, near Narrowsburg, New York, and it was a nice little facility, but I was scared to go see my dad to make amends to him for some reason, and my sponsor kept saying, don't worry about it, God is with you, blah, 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 you know, and I knew that in my head, but in my heart I was still scared. And anyway, I called up Eugene, the guy that was at my first meeting. He went with me, and it was a good ride, you know, it was a good trip up there. And I went to see my dad, and I told him I'm a recovered alcoholic, and I got to do this here to make things right with him. And he laughed at me, you know. And he's 93 back then, but I told him what I need to do to make things right with him. And he said, and I gave him my 20-year medallion, and he read it, and he looked at me, and he said, How could you forgive me? And I go, it has nothing to do about forgiveness. I have to make things right between you and I. And I have to do things that, whatever you want me to do, to be a daughter that I never was able to do, because I had all this rage and prejudice in my eyes. I couldn't see you as another human being. So he told me a couple of things to do, and I did them. You know, simple things, and just to write to him and to call him once in a while, you know, because he was lonely. And he cared about me, you know, and I did for a long time, for about 4 months, and then he fell and he got really sick, and he passed away. But you know, I would just be with him, you know, and it was so good to see my dad on that day, and to see that he was a human being, you know, he was a sick human being, not only then, but throughout his whole life, because he never had the program that I was so freely given. And, yeah, I made those amends, and it was all good. And, you know, and then now when I work with people, when I do 12-step work and when I work with other women and other folks, I have a message to carry them to them, and I have a message of hope, you know, that I don't have to be in that dark, dark, hateful, revengeful life. You know, it was like I was like in a mobile coffin. You know, I was just negative at meetings and just hating, and it's just a really bad place. I never want to go back there. And today my life is so full. You know, like I do work with other people. I do, you know, I do have a 10-step buddies, and I have 11-step buddies, and I go through the Big Book with new people. And like I said, I'm in a Big Book study now with six other folks, and it's just wonderful. And we're supposed to do step three today, you know, kneel down and do the prayer and realize that God is going to take me to a new level. And he does. Every time I do that, every time I go through the Big Book, I find out more who I don't want to be. You know, I don't want to be self-centered. And, you know, every morning I do the 11-step prayer every morning and every night. And because I love that prayer where it talks about help me to divorce my mind from self-pity and self-seeking and dishonesty. And I look up the opposite. What would it look like to be the opposite? And it's just to be honest and to be giving and to be open-handed, open-heart, and be kind to other people. And, you know, when I do that every day and every morning, I just love my job. You know, not only by the place I work, but my job is being a servant to my higher power and to his children, you know, because I never could do that before being an untreated alcoholism. And today life is exciting, you know, and, you know, a lot of uncomfortable things happen, but I don't get so depressed and so negative, you know. I realize that this is part of life, you know, and life comes at us, and life, you know, sometimes isn't just, it's just life, you know, and it's going to happen. And today I know I could walk hand in hand with God and be a worker among workers. And that's one part in the 12 and 12 I liked, you know, to be a worker among workers, not only on my job where I get paid, but during my daily life, you know, walking even in a grocery store or at a bookstore, anywhere. It's just to be kind and generous to other people, because you never know. Because I know when I was living in Binghamton or anywhere, I would be negative to people that I was uncomfortable with. And I remember this guy, he used to chew his coffee. He used to snap his coffee all the time. And I just hated him. You know, I was so negative towards him. I never said anything nice. I never smiled at him or anything. And he committed suicide on Christmas. And I always stuck in my mind that, you know, maybe if people were just kind to him and just over, you know, set all those resentments and fears or dislikes to the side, you know, and look at him like the eyes of God, not to say, well, there's something wrong with him. And there was nothing wrong with him. He was, you know, he was in untreated alcoholism and whatever. It's none of my business. But what my business is my conduct. And so I got to be nice to everyone and tolerant of other people that really irritate me. It's okay. It's very easy for me to tolerate and be kind to people that are nice and I'm comfortable around. But if I'm comfortable around you, it takes a little prayer that God to set my mind right and some breathing. And I'll tell you this quick story is that, you know, a couple of that 2 years ago, I went to work and I told my coworker, I work in a rehab, and I go, that chair is filthy. And he goes, Andre, you're thinking again. And I don't know why he says that to me, but, you know, when I came into the program in 81, that's what they told me. My thinking is unsafe. You know, my thinking is still unsafe. You know, 26 years later, it's still unsafe when I get in my head and try to figure out things and play God and be the director, you know. And I prayed about that in my meditations at 9 in the morning. I realized that if I was really living a spiritual life, I would just go in there, keep my mouth shut, and if I seen something wrong, I would just fix it and not tell anybody about it and just go about my business and to be a worker among workers, you know. And it's so good to be here, and I think I overtalked. I'm not sure how long I was supposed to talk, but I'd love to come here. It's very comfortable, and I noticed there's a lot of antique stores. I think I'll come earlier next time. Thank you very, very much for listening.